the fleets. Agamemnon's flagship led a mighty fleet, befitting the splendour and importance of Mycenae, the largest and most powerful of all the Greek kingdoms. In fact, Agamemnon preferred to call it an empire, an example perhaps of his tendency towards grandiosity. Mycenae was really more a hegemony, a realm that had control and command over many others. At its greatest, between 1750 and 1100 BC, or thereabouts, that control was exerted as far east as Athens and Thebes on the Greek mainland, as well as islands and kingdoms in the eastern Aegean, and as far west as Pylos and south as Crete. By all the gods in heaven, was he glad to be going home. The army under his command had done what it had set out to do. It had rescued the honour of the House of Atreus and the reputation of the Hellenes. The indomitable, impregnable Troy had fallen. Helen had been restored to Menelaus, all under the generalship of Agamemnon, king of men. On his Aristeia, his day of glory, he had slaughtered more Trojans than any other warrior. None could doubt his prowess as both commander in the tent and warrior in the field. Yet somehow Agamemnon always felt that the awe, wonder, and worship accorded to Achilles, Odysseus, Diomedes, Ajax, Patroclus, Nestor, and Teucer had never quite been accorded him. Achilles? Well, of course, none came close to Achilles, the nonsuch, the golden nonpareil. That was to be expected. But even Menelaus was held in greater respect and affection by the men in the ranks. Agamemnon loved his brother dearly. But it was, after all, Menelaus whose loose hold on his wife had caused the whole damn disaster to unfold in the first place. As for the gods, every single one of those heroes had been aided by an Olympian during the course of the war, every single one except Agamemnon. On the other side, Ares, Aphrodite and Apollo assisted Paris, Hector and the Trojans at every opportunity too. Why was he, Agamemnon, so despised and overlooked? The burdens of command. No one loves a general. Blamed for every disaster, but denied credit for every victory. From the very beginning, Agamemnon had to make decisions that would have torn a lesser man in two. To sacrifice his daughter Iphigenia or lose the war. To succumb to the humiliating demands of Achilles or lose him from the field. To take the risk of implementing Odysseus's scheme to leave a great horse on the plain of Ilium for the Trojans to discover, or follow the safe course of turning down so reckless and untried a stratagem. In the end, he trusted the guileful devil. Plenty warned him against it, but he went with his instinct. No one remembered that now. Agamemnon was not one of the heroes who hid in the belly of the horse. He was the dullard waiting in his ship around the bay with reinforcements. No glory there. Well, well, he knew self-pity to be an abject failing. All over now. Soon the dust and stench of war would be out of his nostrils, and he would be home and in the arms of his wife, Clytemnestra. She was not completely her sister Helen's equal when it came to sheer physical beauty. Of course, no one was. That was the cause of all the trouble. But Clytemnestra came closer than any other woman he had ever seen. What was more, she had a style and poise about her, an elegance and authority that acted on him like a fierce potion, and that Helen, for all her natural grace and loveliness, could not quite match. He would see his children. Electra must be 17 or 18 years old by now, the age Iphigenia was when she... Orestes would be just 11 or 12, and little Chrysothemis barely older than 10. When Agamemnon left for the war, she had been growing inside Clytemnestra, and Orestes had just learnt to totter on his own two legs and pronounce a few words. Had Clytemnestra seen to their education, he wondered? Were they able to sing and recite poetry? Could Orestes ride a horse and swing a sword? And Electra, what of her? He pictured a prince of Corinth or Attica sighing beneath her window. Let his armour rust. He would devote his life to his family. How much better to be a father of three than a ruler of thousands. Meanwhile, they were ready to sail. But what was that noise? The Princess Cassandra. Night and day she wailed, forecasting all kinds of nonsense. Her sobs and screams merged with the shrieks of the seabirds overhead as his captain cast off and Agamemnon bade goodbye to the hated shoreline at last. The 12 ships of Odysseus's Ithacan fleet had the wind against them when they left Troy. Blown northwards, they made landfall on the Thracian coast, outside the city of Ismarus, the capital of the Sicones. Thrace today is mostly Bulgaria, but includes parts of northern Greece and Macedonia. No one is sure exactly where Ismarus is or was. It was the Siconian women who, outraged by his preference for young men, had hacked Orpheus to pieces. The citizens of Ismarus were no match for the war-hardened Ithacans, who slaughtered the men and took the pick of the town's women and treasure to their ships. 10 years of brutal fighting had all but banished mercy and compassion from Odysseus, but when his men, baying for blood, brought before him the local prince, Maron, a priest of Apollo, Odysseus felt himself sickened. He turned to his second-in-command and brother-in-law, Eurylochus, who, with a group of 12 men, all brandishing swords, had pushed the prince before him. "Damn it, are we men or are we beasts? Before long we'll be drinking blood and feasting on flesh like the harpies. It is possible to enjoy yourselves without slaughter and rape. This is a virtuous man. Let go of him." Eurylochus and the men put up their swords and backed away, leaving Odysseus with the prince, who fell to the ground and grasped him around the knees. "You're a good man, sir, a merciful man." Odysseus swatted the compliment away as if it had been a mosquito. "Don't think it, I'm a tired one, that is more to the point. Tired of killing, tired of travel, ready for home. I'm a careful man, too. I've seen what happens when men disrespect temples and their priests." Maron smiled. "It is not an insult to call a man good, you know. But we will have it your way. You spoke of drinking blood. Perhaps I may express my gratitude to you by offering you something better to drink." Maron clapped his hands and gave commands to fetch a servant, who presently came forward with 2 goblets of wine. Odysseus took one and drank it down. He gasped with pleasure. "Dionysus himself could not drink a better vintage than this. I thank you." "I shall send 12 large flagons down to your ship," said Maron, "but with a warning. This wine is strong, fantastically concentrated. The cup you just drank was 20 parts water. That is the least you must dilute it by. Anything stronger and a single sip will make you feel as if Heracles himself had clubbed you on the head." They drank 2 more cups of the wine, correctly mixed, and parted on terms of mutual respect. Odysseus returned to his ship and called for Eurylochus. "Order the men back to their ships. I want us underway before dawn."
"Don't think the men would like that, my lord. Not while there's still loot and fun to be had on land."
It wasn't a question of whether Odysseus liked Eurylochus or loathed him, The man had fought through the 10 years of battle as bravely as any. No one knew the men and their moods better. Besides, Eurylochus was married to Odysseus's young sister Timine, which granted him the privilege of frankness and informality when speaking in the presence of his royal brother-in-law. As to Odysseus's family back home, there had been no news from Ithaca of his father, King Laertes, or his mother, Anticlea, or his wife Penelope and son Telemachus. Such thoughts rekindled his urgency. "I don't care what the men would or would not like. Enough loot has been divided between the 12 ships, and we must catch the next tide." In the eyes of many, Odysseus was already something close to a legend. His creative cunning had won the war. Stories of his wit and guile had spread around the world. But the man could shoot an arrow and cast a spear, too. He could wrestle and run. He could squat down by the fire and feast with the common soldier as easily as he could, so the whisper went, commune with Athena herself. But leadership survives on the keenest edge of the sharpest sword. It is always, somewhere deep down, by consent that rulers rule. Grudging approval, silent acquiescence, conditional agreement. The great rulers are those who know how far their authority may be pushed. Eurylochus made it clear, with a great many, "my lords," each, as was his manner, in the heaviest of quotation marks, that the men would not take kindly to an early order to leave Ismarus. No, not kindly at all. Odysseus had yielded. "We will be last home," he had muttered. "The wind is perfect now." But over the next 2 days, the men continued to ransack, murder, and pillage. On the third night, they slaughtered dozens of oxen and sheep and feasted triumphantly on the shore. They did not know that a few survivors of the Cicones from Ismarus had crept out of the city and over the hills to rouse their neighbours. Neighbours who now thundered down in chariots to exact their revenge. Odysseus left his ship to join in a battle which was bloody and humiliating. 70 Ithacans lost their lives. Their bodies had been left stripped and open to the buzzards and dogs, deprived of holy burial and the praise songs that were their due. Sailing away from the coast, Odysseus sent word along the ships that the names of each of the dead should be called out, together with prayers for their souls. "A bad business, sire," Eurylochus remarked, "but maybe good will come of it."
"Good? What good?"
"Well, the experience might teach the men that we touch land only for water and provisions, and stay no longer than is needed for that. Clear run now, eh, my lord?"
"Clear? Does that look clear to you?"
Eurylochus turned and swore. The horizon behind him had turned black. The silence between Helen and Menelaus was strung out taut and tight between them, like the rigging of the ship that bore them home. Menelaus had rescued his wife from a monstrous abduction. Paris, son of King Priam, had stolen her away from Sparta and installed her in Troy as his own wife. This abominable act was a gash in the order of things from which rivers of blood had flowed. Tens of thousands of lives had been lost as the Trojans fought to keep her and the Greeks to win her back. How many widows, how many fatherless children, how many grieving parents? Only the fates could keep count. The story told and sung loudly all over the world was of a beautiful queen snatched against her will from her loving husband and children. But rumour murmured to scandal, and scandal whispered to gossip, and gossip winked to the world, wondering just how much forcible abducting had really been required for Helen to accompany Paris to Troy. Paris was a most handsome prince, more than handsome. He flowered from the same royal Trojan tree as Ganymede and Tithonus, reckoned the loveliest of youths ever to have been seen in the world. The immortals themselves had been unable to resist their beauty. And another question arose, too. Surely a woman of such known resource could have found a time in all those long, terrible years of war to escape the walls of Troy and cross to the Greek lines. Any woman of will could have done it. The bribing of a few maids and guards was all it would have taken. When Menelaus had finally broken into Helen's bedchamber after the walls of Troy were breached, had she rushed into his arms with wild cries of joy? Or had there been a diffidence, a stiff awkwardness between them? For certain there was a stiff enough awkwardness now, as she kept to one end of the Spartan flagship, he to the other. They met in the middle for meals. She smiled as sweetly as she knew how. He bowed and pulled her chair back to seat her, as if he were not her king, husband, and lover, but no more than an embarrassed page or steward. This day, their third at sea, long out of sight of the Trojan shore, Menelaus resolved to have it out with her.
"Some dates to sweeten the mutton?"
This first conversational sally was met with a shake of the head and a mouthed thank you that made no sound.
"By heaven, she's as lovely now as the day I first saw her," thought Menelaus. "The wind favours us. Home soon."
The silence swelled.
"If you're not hungry, perhaps we can take a turn about the deck. I would like so much to talk to you."
She rose, still silent, and followed him up. He gripped the rail hard and spoke more to the salt spray than to her.
"Helen," he said, "I had hoped you... I thought you would be pleased at least to be with me, to be in my company, that your rescue would be everything you had prayed for. Instead, I feel..."
"Oh, no. No, of course I'm pleased. Of course I'm happy. So happy to be going home with you, my husband. But you must know what kindness I was shown by King Priam, Queen Hecuba, Prince Hector, Princess Andromache, and many others. Not once did they make me feel..."
"And he? Paris?"
Menelaus could barely speak the cursed name.
"He? No. He was not so kind. I was a prize he soon tired of." "But Menelaus, what is that?"
The change in the tone of Helen's voice was startling. She was staring over Menelaus's shoulder. He looked up. The horizon behind him had turned black. Agamemnon walked the deck alongside his prophet, Calchas.
"When we find home harbour in Mycenae, my lord, it will be important to make offerings to both Poseidon and Zeus the moment you land. From then on, all will be peace and prosperity for the house of Atreus. So it is ordained."
From below came the sound of Cassandra's voice, hoarse with effort.
"He knows nothing, dead king! Only murder awaits you! Your death and mine!"
"That's good to hear, Calchas," said Agamemnon. "And what of our voyage?"
"A clear run home, sire."
Said Agamemnon. "If that is the case, why should the sky behind you be turning black?"
Between the ships of Odysseus and the ships of Menelaus lay the 40 Locrian vessels of Ajax's fleet. Odysseus had denounced him and demanded his stoning, the ranks of the Greek army had cursed him for provoking the anger of the gods. But his countrymen, the Locrians who had sailed to Troy with him and stayed by his side for 10 years of fighting, they adored him. So much so, in fact, that even centuries later, when they went into battle, they left a space for him in their ranks, as they believed his spirit still fought with them. Ajax was brave, good-humoured, considerate, companionable. He was one of them. He ate and drank with his men, shared the prizes of war with them, and knew them all by name. They were proud of his record of valour, his prowess with the spear, and his fleetness of foot, second only to that of Golden Achilles. But the madness that had overtaken him in the temple of Athena caused great unease. Over years and years, some varieties of wine, no one quite knew how or why, fermented within the wood, the pressure within the barrel growing and growing until it must burst out in a violent fountain. The war over, Ajax had fizzed and exploded like one of those barrels. His men did not believe that he had raped Cassandra, however. They saw this as a monstrous lie told by Agamemnon's mouthpiece, the false prophet Calchas. A lie that gave Agamemnon a pretext for seizing Cassandra for himself. After Queen Hecuba, who had turned quite mad, Cassandra was the greatest royal prize of all. Nonetheless, Ajax was now leaning against the sternpost, sucking oysters from their shells without a care.
"My lord! My lord!"
Ajax cocked his head as Phinos, his second-in-command, hurried towards him.
"Something wrong?"
"Look! Look!"
Ajax turned. A dark and heavy band was approaching the ship. Not in the sea, but up in the sky. With it came a noise, an unspeakable shrieking.
"Birds, my lord! Birds!"
Wave after wave of seabirds were flying towards them, so low that Phinos flung himself down on the deck as they screamed and flapped over the ship. Thousands and thousands passed over. The thump and thrum of their beating wings was deep, like the booming of a distant storm. Ajax pulled Phinos to his feet.
"They're fleeing that," he said, pointing.
The horizon behind him had turned black. Eurylochus signalled to the other 11 ships of the Ithacan fleet to turn about. The storm would outrun them, of course, but it would be undignified to hang about like a mouse frozen by an uprearing snake and wait for it to consume them.
"Tell the men to ship their oars. We'll let the surge carry us. Pointless to fight it."
Agamemnon yelled the instructions into his bosun's cupped ear. It was hard to know if his commands could be heard over the screams of the wind or the screams of Cassandra.
"The storm is nothing! We will survive the storm! The waters of the wide sea are harmless! Beware the warm waters of home!"
Menelaus and his captain watched as the vessels of their fleet formed up, line astern.
"Just came out of nowhere, sire. Only the gods can whip up storm so fast. This is Poseidon himself."
"And we know why," said Menelaus.
"Curse Ajax! Curse him!"
Ajax shook his head and laughed.
"No, not Poseidon. I pray and sacrifice to him with a devotion no other mortal can match. Poseidon loves me. He would never do this."
"Poseidon or not, my lord, that is one monster of a storm.
Set the slaves to their oars, spread sails, and make in the same direction those birds were flying. They know where the nearest land is."